This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Ajamu Baraka joins us to talk about the six illegal wars following the attacks on September 11, 2001.
It's been 16 years, six subsequent wars. Ajamu Baraka is the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, which is part of the United National Anti-War Coalition. They're organizing demonstrations from October 2nd to October 8th. You can be part of it. Give a listen.
We speak with the mother of a young man swept up in a massive police raid in the Bronx.
There are well over 100 young people in the poorest community in America who've been swept up and turned against each other. This will give you a window into how the feds operate in the poor communities of our country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
16 years ago today, on September 11th, 2001, two hijacked planes flew into the Twin Towers and another one into the Pentagon. 15 of the 19 attackers were Saudi Arabians. They were funded by elements of the Saudi Arabian government. Osama bin Laden, a Saudi Arabian fundamentalist from a wealthy Saudi family, took responsibility for the attack. He said he did it for three reasons: the American support of Israel against the Palestinians, the presence of U.S. bases near the Saudi Arabian holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and the U.S. economic and trade sanctions against Iraq, which killed 600,000 children. When the attack occurred, the feckless and unpopular George W. Bush had been in office less than a year. He told his national security advisor to figure out a way to blame the attacks on Iraq dictator Saddam Hussein. A lie was then propounded by Bush, his vice president Dick Cheney, and his secretary of defense Donald Rumsfeld that Iraq had contact with Osama bin Laden and that Iraq was developing nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction. First, Afghanistan was bombed, even though its leaders offered to turn over Osama bin Laden. Then an illegal war was launched against Iraq, initiated with horrific bombings called Shock and Awe. In the following years, 1 million people were killed in that country. One half of the population are refugees or internally displaced. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the Patriot Act was hastily pushed through Congress, bringing an American police state closer into being. The war on terror was declared, even though terror is a tactic and war is traditionally something fought between two nations. This has given the war a permanent character. A campaign of fear was whipped up. Torture and kidnapping by the CIA were instituted. Eventually, the United States under President Obama was fighting six wars simultaneously in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia. Trump continues this aggression. Here to speak with us today is returning guest Ajamu Baraka. He is a member of the board of directors of the Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, an editor and contributing columnist for Black Agenda Report, and the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, which is part of the United National Anti-War Coalition. They have called anti-war actions for October 2nd through October 8th.
Ajamu, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Addie. It's my pleasure to be with you.
The United States attacked Afghanistan within a month of 9/11, despite the fact that the Taliban offered to cooperate in capturing Osama bin Laden, who later escaped Pakistan. Do you think the American attack on Afghanistan was illegal?
Well, Addie, there's no question that it was, in fact, an illegal invasion and subsequent occupation. The U.S. attempted to try to provide a legal justification for the invasion by evoking Article 5 of the NATO treaty, suggesting that they had been attacked and that them, along with their NATO allies, had a responsibility and a justification to attack Afghanistan as a state. But as you said in your question, the Afghan authorities were attempting to communicate with the U.S. They had offered to, in fact, turn over Osama bin Laden as long as the U.S. would provide some evidence that he was directly involved in the attack in New York. But, of course, they did not take them up on that offer, and instead they decided to physically invade the nation. Most legal scholars agree today that that was, in fact, an illegal invasion. The U.S. Could not and did not go through the proper U.N. Channels, primarily the Security Council, because one of the requirements to engage in military action is if your nation is facing an imminent threat. It's clear there was no imminent threat of further attack from any state. In fact, we all know that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. So there was no state-on-state attack. This was purely a bogus justification for moving on a state that they had already threatened a year earlier with invasion if they did not open up themselves to more U.S. Investment. So this is part of the justifications used by this powerful U.S. state to take advantage of various situations that either they help to produce or react to in order to advance their own particular national interests. And the people who pay the price, of course, are the soldiers that died in Afghanistan and the people of that nation also.
Do you think the real reason for attacking Afghanistan was to control the country for building oil and gas pipelines?
I think that ended up being one of the reasons for the continued occupation. I think that it's clear that they had their eyes on further controlling that part of the world for no other reason than to serve as a block to the Chinese. I mean, Afghanistan is strategically situated where it borders a number of strategic states that the U.S. is concerned with. The Chinese, is close to Russia. It's right in the heart of Central Asia. And in fact, we see today that part of the strategy of the U.S. seems to be that they're going to remain a permanent fixture in that part of the world to, again, block the Chinese so-called New Silk Road Project. They have, some people estimate, between 7 and 9 permanent bases in Afghanistan for that purpose. But what they discovered also in 2010 was that apparently there is something to the tune of over $1 trillion worth of mineral wealth in Afghanistan, caches of iron, copper, gold, and what they claim might be one of the largest deposits of lithium in the world. And of course, you have gas and oil pipelines and resources. So it is now providing a more substantial material incentive for U.S. corporations to remain physically in that part of the world. And I suspect that may have been the considerations that the Trump administration engaged in to help explain why he moved from, as a candidate, making an argument that he would withdraw from Afghanistan to now, as president, deciding that there's some objective conditions there that require the U.S. to stay in that country.
Jaimo, at the time the war against Afghanistan was initiated, Laura Bush, the First Lady, said that a benefit of the American war on Afghanistan was to help oppressed Afghani women. And this was sold to the public as a justification for the war. Today, infants in Afghanistan have the least chance of reaching age 1 of any country in the world. How have women and the population as a whole fared under the U.S. military occupation of their country?
Well, whenever you have military conflict, the sector of the population that tends to suffer the most are women and children. And that's been the case during this conflict. So the situation of women and children in that country has been horrendous. The only sector of the population, one might argue, has benefited somewhat from The new government is in Afghanistan are women in some of the urban centers, primarily middle-class women in the urban centers. But, you know, this is one of the consequences of these kind of actions that, you know, they will hook themselves to a propaganda line. That's something that they know will resonate in the U.S. It doesn't really matter if objectively, if in reality, it is all a pack of deceit. Their main concern is to project the line and to justify and get public support for their actions. So we know that the Taliban are not friends to women. It is a movement that has at its center a patriarchal code of conduct, and we know that it is not something that we would define as progressive. But this notion that the U.S. has the right and responsibility to engage in military activities in order to save various populations is a dangerous development, something that has been at the center of the justifications for most of the interventions over the last almost now two decades, this whole notion of humanitarian intervention. So this is a dangerous doctrine and one in which we have to be very, very careful of when we see those kinds of justifications being deployed to justify U.S. And Western Europe interventions.
After Afghanistan, the United States attacked Iraq in a display of what was called shock and awe. Was this war legal?
Of course not. And the justifications for it, again, was to a thinly produced notion that Iraq represented a imminent threat to the U.S., that it was, it had so-called weapons of mass destruction, that it would deploy against the U.S., or that it would pass on to quote-unquote terrorists. And there they made the connection that it was really laughable in most parts of the world, that Saddam Hussein was in league with al-Qaeda, and because everybody knew and knows that al-Qaeda saw the Saddam Hussein regime as an enemy, one in which they were deeply opposed to. But those were the justifications that were used to sell the invasion to the U.S. public. They even implied, even though they tried to backtrack on it, but the connection was also made in the minds of the public that some kind of way Iraq was, in fact, involved in the attack in New York. And, in fact, there were a pose of U.S. service personnel who went to Iraq where it indicated that almost 60% of the service members thought that Iraq had a direct hand in the attacks in New York. So, no, this was an illegal invasion, and we have witnessed the horrible consequences of that invasion, the destabilization of the entire so-called Middle East, the destruction of an ancient civilization, the deaths of some people who estimate up to a million people, the consequence of this action. It is really a horrendous undertaking that we've seen the U.S. involved in. They've been involved in a veritable rampage that started with the invasion of Afghanistan and move into Iraq. It's really been something that history is not going to look at very favorably.
Can we get at the real purpose of the American war against Iraq? We had an historian, Professor Smith, on the show who had written a biography of President Bush. He claimed that Bush was acting on behalf of an order by God, that God had told him to do it. But apart from that justification, what was the real purpose for them going to war in Iraq? There was a lot of propaganda that they were going to bring democracy to Iraq. Well, that didn't happen. I mean, how do you get a handle on this?
Iraq had 19 billion barrels of oil reserves. That was number one. And we're talking about an administration that had its primary base of support from the oil industry. So that was part of it. Secondly, they knew, they felt that Iraq was theirs for the taking, that it had been basically as a consequence of the sanctions and the dismemberment of the nation. It was there for their taking. It had been softened up, and all they needed was a pretext to move in and to engage in a process of direct colonization, which was scandalous and a complete failure. But, you know, their calculations were that they could, in fact, take that that territory, take the oil, and be situated in the heart of the so-called Middle East. But, of course, it was a disaster. They, in fact, as a consequence of the destruction of the Iraqi state and their inability to manage the affairs of that state, they, in fact, ended up enhancing the regional power of Iran, that we could talk about later, I guess. But, you know, the real objective was basic imperialist incentives. That they felt that they could take that territory, hold it, exploit it, and be strategically situated to continue to influence and control a vital part of the world.
Ajamu, thereafter, neighboring Syria became the target of American aggression. Was this legal?
There's nothing that the U.S. has done in the last 16 years that's been legal in terms of these invasions. In fact, when you look at the Syria, even the allowing their vassal states to arm a insurgency inside their country was illegal. Their direct and indirect facilitation of that process, training of insurgents, providing arms to insurgents, all of that is deemed illegal within the context of the UN Charter. So, no, this is another illegal action. It was an attempt to try to counter the disastrous policies of the last decade, 12, 13 years in that part of the world by enhancing the power of the Iranians. It made Syria and controlling Syria a more strategic necessity to counter the power of the Iranians. They knew that in order to undermine Iranian power, it was important to try to take the Syrian state out of from a functioning state to a weak and dismembered state. And that was one of the main reasons why they decided to move on Syria. So no, it was illegal. And again, it's part of a disastrous policy that has resulted in the destabilization of the entire region and the death and destruction of another ancient civilization. And when we talk about cities like Damascus and Aleppo, we're talking about cities that are thousands of years old, a developed civilization. But now you look at these places and they are now shells of their former selves, as a consequence of this activity by this Western nation. It is really a sad sight. But no, this is again a continuation of a failed policy in that part of the world that has exposed the relative weakness of the U.S. state. See, many people have to understand that in essence the U.S. Lost in Afghanistan. The war is finished. Everybody knows that they have lost that conflict. And what they're trying to do now is to at least force the Taliban into allowing some kind of presence on the part of the U.S. in the eastern part of Afghanistan. So they were defeated in Afghanistan. They were defeated in Iraq. They have been defeated, in essence, in Syria. So it exposed the U.S. to the fact that it is, in fact, a paper tiger. And it's part of the relative decline of U.S. power, because those wars had to be paid for. The weaknesses of the U.S. Militarily was exposed. I think that those conflicts help explain the rapid decline of U.S. global power.
Ajamu, the United States is aiding the Saudi Arabian government in its attack on Yemen. It just concluded an arms deal with it in the amount of tens of billions of dollars. Why is our government doing this?
This agreement was negotiated under the Obama administration and then carried out or finalized to a certain extent under the Trump administration. This is big business. This is part of the military-industrial complex's strategy and agenda. They are producing these weapons, and they want these weapons to be sold. The Saudis have played the role of the recipients of these expensive weapon systems. And when you have these expensive weapon systems, you have the Saudis buying those systems, and they want to use them in order to advance their own specific geopolitical objectives, in this case, to control the politics of Yemen. Not only are they given a green light by the U.S., but the U.S. provides logistical support to the attack by the Saudis on the people of Yemen. So it is part of the business of war, and they knew that the most of the public in the U.S. would be either unaware or not really concerned. And so they have allowed the Saudis to basically commit acts of genocide in Saudi Arabia. And even, you know, the fact that you have people who are supposed to be progressives like Bernie Sanders, who would talk about the Saudis needing to get their hands more dirty in the Middle East, and that be roundly condemned for that in the light of what has occurred in Yemen, is just another reflection of the impoverished left politics in the U.S. That this is allowed to happen, that you have a humanitarian disaster in Yemen, you have people who are dying, you have the U.S. Navy that's helping to enforce a blockade of that country with no real opposition from the public in the U.S. The question is, why is the government doing this? They're doing it because they can.
We've been speaking with Ajamu Baraka, former board member at the Center for Constitutional Rights and currently the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu, coming back to Afghanistan, President Trump recently approved the sending of thousands of more soldiers to Afghanistan. He wouldn't talk about how many or for how long or what they were going to do there. He said that that was a secret because he didn't want to let the Afghanis know what he was doing. What's your assessment of Trump's latest move?
Well, you know, it's the argument that he can make these kinds of moves and not have to reveal numbers and costs to the U.S. Congress is absolutely ridiculous. The U.S. Presidency is not a dictatorship. He's not an emperor. These operations have to be paid for by Congress, and so Congress has a right to know what those details are, one. Secondly, it is a continuation of the failed policies we've been talking about, that, again, the real objective is to try to force the Taliban they know that they're going to have to negotiate with the Taliban eventually. And what they're trying to do now is create certain realities on the ground so that when they do come to the table and negotiate their leaving the territories, that they will be allowed to at least retain some presence inside the Afghan territory in those permanent bases they have built on the eastern part of the country. This is just a continuation of that failed strategy, that it is there's no victory in Afghanistan. They know that. Most analysts know that. Unfortunately, though, the U.S. people don't seem to understand that completely.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what we can do about it, what our listeners can do about it. You're the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, and you're part of the United National Anti-War Coalition, and they've called for actions from October 2nd to October 8th. Talk to us about this and how our listeners can get involved in this.
Well, you know, first, let me just mention very quickly why we have established the Black Alliance for Peace. The Black Alliance for Peace is our attempt to try to revive and rebuild the anti-war movement in the U.S. The first phase of that, though, is to revive the traditional anti-war positions in the black community. As many of your listeners know, one of the most consistently anti-war communities in the U.S. Has been the U.S. up until the ascendancy of Barack Obama. So we're trying to recapture that spirit, that critical posture among the black population vis-a-vis war activity on the part of the U.S. state and our traditional anti-imperialist perspective. And we see that as a vital element in attempting to try to build the broader anti-war movement. And that's why we are involved with the United National Anti-War Coalition to lend our support and be part of that process of rebuilding an anti-war movement. And we believe it's possible now that, you know, now that we passed the sort of period of non-thinking characterized by the 8 years of the Obama administration, and we feel that now we have a strategic opening to really rebuild this movement. So part of what we're trying to do now is in October we are trying to encourage people around the country to step up, to engage in community dialogues, teach-ins on the issues of Afghanistan and now North Korea, on the whole issue of American militarism and imperialism. We want people to be aware of the fact that the only way we're going to be able to block the moves by this administration to consolidate the permanent war agenda is by building a powerful popular opposition. And so this is these activities will be our efforts to do that. As you know, we have the Black Alliance for Peace. We have been speaking out on policies of the Trump administration, both in Afghanistan, but now in North Korea. We issued a statement yesterday condemning the saber-rattling on the part of the Trump administration and the threats that it's making to engage in war on that country, which will result in a humanitarian catastrophe for the people of North Korea, but also for the people of South Korea. We have condemned the threats against Venezuela. And all of these are connected. And we have, of course, condemned what we consider to be a declaration of war against Black America with the lifting of the restrictions as part of the 1033 program, that Department of Defense program that allows for military hardware to be transferred from the military straight to the police forces, which is the program primarily responsible for the militarization of police forces across the country. Under the Obama administration, there was a temporary restriction on some items, and the Trump administration has reversed that. And so for us, we see that as another clear declaration of war on the Black community. So we are linking up domestic repression and militarization with our concern with militarization and war abroad. And those are the kind of links that the United National Anti-War Coalition is also making. So right now we have, I think, a strategic opening and indeed a responsibility to rebuild a powerful anti-war, anti-repression, anti-imperialist movement here in this country. And so the activities in October are part of this effort to try to rebuild this anti-war presence in the U.S.
John Mubaraka, how can our listeners get a hold of Black Alliance for Peace or the United National Anti-War Coalition?
We encourage everyone to, and we need the support, to go to the our website, blackallianceforpeace.com. Please, you have categories where you can be a supporter and or an endorser. We are attempting to do this work with no resources. We don't have any, and I'm not attempting to solicit any foundational money, and definitely no corporate money, of course. We are depending on the people's support for this, and we strongly encourage you to help us to maintain the integrity of our work. You can also go to the United National Anti-War Coalition's website to get more information on the activities in October. We're also part of a movement now to focus in on the U.S. bases, military bases worldwide. So we are involved in a number of activities. And so please go to the website and support us, follow us. You can sign up for the newsletters and support the work in rebuilding this anti-war movement here in this country.
Yeah, I just want to add that the United States has some 1,000 bases around the world in 70% of the world's countries. And any support that people can give to the United National Anti-War Coalition and the Black Alliance for Peace is a step in the right direction. We don't have the kind of anti-war movement these days that we had during Vietnam, but it's something that has to be reconstructed.
Exactly.
Ajamu, as usual, it's been a pleasure to have you on with us.
Lots of luck in what you're building. You have our wholehearted support. We thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, and I really enjoy the conversation, and looking forward to the next time.
You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Pre-dawn in the Williamsburg section of the North Bronx. 700 law enforcement officers arrested many, and later 120 young men were indicted on conspiracy charges using the 1970 RICO Act. In one apartment, more than a dozen police threw flashbang grenades and broke down the front door with assault weapons aimed at a mother and her two daughters. They forced them to crawl down the hall on all fours toward the officers. At the time, police held a press conference, characterizing the young men as, quote, the epitome of organized crime today. Cooperating federal agencies included the Drug Enforcement Administration, the ATF, the U.S. Attorney General, and ICE's Homeland Security Investigations. Community members questioned this portrayal, saying the young men were not highly organized gangsters terrorizing a community. They lacked money, they lacked weapons, and they were living at home with their families. Critics also claim that applying RICO to street gangs has racist implications. Under RICO, individuals can be found guilty by association. Despite gang-related crime accounting for less than 2% of city crime overall, 2 weeks after the raid, James O'Neill, now NYPD commissioner, promised more. O'Neill came through with that promise this past April. Multiple arrests were made at the Boston Secor houses in the Bronx, and federal charges were brought against 19 young persons. They have been charged with racketeering conspiracy, narcotics conspiracy, robbery conspiracy, extortion, and firearms offenses. We're joined today by a family member of one of the young men who was arrested this past April. To respect her privacy, and as many families, to avoid fear of retaliation, we're addressing her merely as Mrs. R. Mrs. R., welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us today. About a year ago, we did a segment on the police raids in the Bronx, where over 100 individuals were indicted on RICO charges. And we understand that this past April, there was a similar raid in the Boston Secor houses. Can you tell us where those are?
The Boston Secor houses is on Boston Road between Baychester and Dyer Avenue, most likely. The cross streets would be Boston Road and Reesma Lane. It's in the Bronx. And basically, it's called Eastchester Bronx, Eastchester part of the Bronx.
Okay. And how far is that from where the raids occurred a year ago, April?
If you're talking about Eastchester Garden?
Yes.
That's about maybe by car, it could be about 10 5 minutes away. By the bus, maybe about 20 to 30 minutes by the bus.
Okay, and during the usual weekday, is there any police presence in the Boston Sea Corps houses?
Yes, there's police around, but there's more police now.
After the raid.
Different little things keep happening. Yes, after the raid, there's been more police.
And can you describe to us the day this past April when the raid happened? Where were you? How did you hear about it?
Okay, what happened was, from my understanding, they went into, they knocked on people's doors at 4:30 in the morning. Okay, so they acquired all of the people who they were looking for around about 4:30. Some people weren't home. I guess they got picked up later. Or if they weren't, they were sleeping or whatever, and maybe they didn't get them till later. But basically, it started 4:30 in the morning when the Fed, because it wasn't the police who came here. It was the Fed.
I think they were from Department of Homeland Security.
Their jacket said Fed, F-E-D-S on it.
Oh.
That's what the jacket said. When people came outside, they saw that the jacket said Fed.
Now, your son was arrested.
Yes, he was.
And how did you find out about that?
Well, I got a phone call. Somebody called me and told me what was going on. And that's how I actually found out, through a phone call.
What was your reaction when you heard that?
I was upset. I didn't know what was going on. So I came around that way to see what was going on. Or whatever, and they basically had him in the police car. They had all of them in the car, and they basically was driving off. As a matter of fact, I heard that they went into a family's house that did not have anything to do with it, but they was looking for a particular person, and they pulled their guns out. The young man's mother was in there sick. She has an oxygen machine, and they went into the house. And they had him on the floor with guns pointed at his head, and he wasn't even the person they were looking for. They was in the wrong apartment.
How many people altogether were rounded up?
About 19.
And what were they charged with?
They were all charged with different things. Some people were charged with murder. Some people were charged with drugs, selling drugs, being a distributor. Some people were charged with being in a gang, the slut gang. And a lot of them were charged with the RICO law. They all were picked up through the RICO law. Some of these young men don't even know each other. Some of them grew up around here, so they know each other because they grew up. Not that they hung out with each other, but some of them grew up and from when they were little kids. Some of the families that are here grew up here, and then they had children here. So with that being said, a lot of them know each other. Or whatever, but they most likely don't hang out together. And then some of them didn't even live around here. Some of them live in Co-op City. Some of them live different places. So I don't know basically why they connected them all together. Because they say hello to each other. Because, and from my understanding, I was told that they was doing this investigation since 2010. And if you're doing an investigation from 2010, then you really should already know who the slut gang is. You know that a lot of those young men from around here was not part of the slut gang.
Who are the slut gang?
I actually don't know. That was the first time we all heard about a slut gang.
Uh-huh.
So all I heard from hearsay is that the slut gang comes from young men on Dyer Avenue. And they have a couple of friends that live in Building 1. So that's basically all I know about that situation from the kids talking outside. And like I said, people be around here. We a lot of people know each other. So you're going to hear different things from other families or from young men that, who are out here who know what's going on the street. You're going to hear certain things from them. And that's how we all found out about the slut gang coming from Dyer Avenue and that they have a few friends that live in Building 1. And, but basically nobody around here is slut gang. That's just something that the feds are using to build their case against these young men.
Now, do you have any idea how your son came to be arrested in terms of Is there anyone he was friends with or even just knew who might have been involved in criminal activity and they linked?
That's what I'm understanding, that because of the RICO law, you could go to work every day and come home and maybe you can be outside and you see somebody you know and you give them five and y'all chit chat for a little while, and because of association, they might pick you up as part of the RICO law. So you could be innocent as all heck and get picked up because you know somebody.
Right.
But I'm also hearing that they're holding on to these young men because they're looking for them to snitch on each other or tell them who they know that might have killed someone in the valley. That happened years ago. A 16-year-old young man was killed in the valley years ago. And then another young man was killed on Reeves Mill Lane while sitting in a U-Haul truck. So I'm also hearing that rumors that that's who they're really looking for, those people. But in the meantime, these other young men have to suffer.
Right.
And go through what they're going through because the feds are looking for someone.
Now, do you have any evidence or have you heard from others if the feds have actually asked any of these young persons to snitch on others?
Yes. I spoke to a mother who grew up around here, and I spoke to a mother, and she informed me that that's all one of the lawyers keep bringing up to her son. That's all the lawyer wants to know, if he knows anything about the murders, and trying to get him to talk. I also heard that they're offering different people like less time or something like that to give them information or to snitch or whatever, however the young people put it, snitch. Yes, they are doing that.
Right. Okay, that's good to know. In terms of legal representation, do all of the young people who've been arrested have, court-appointed attorneys, as far as you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they all have court-appointed attorneys. Maybe one might not have, because from my understanding, his mother is a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he might not have a court-appointed attorney, but the majority of them do. And with the Fed cases, most of these lawyers, regular lawyers are, the non-Fed lawyers are charging $25,000 and up. So it's hard for a lot of these parents to pay that kind of money to get a lawyer to defend their child. And the feds know that. They know what they're doing. They know that a lot of parents can't afford to pay for a lawyer to get their child. So their child is going to be railroaded.
What do you say, Mrs. R., to some of the neighbors who might approve of these drastic police measures, because eventually some dangerous people will be incarcerated?
Yes. To some of the people out there, I feel like if you don't know what's going on and you don't know what's happening, then you shouldn't make any comments. Because just like I'm bringing up certain things I heard with hearsay or whatever the case, you don't know if what you're hearing is hearsay. You know, I hear things from, I can speak on something that I heard from a parent directly or from a person going through something directly. You know, I can speak on that or whatever the case, but also I can also say certain things are hearsay. But these young people on this block, they know what's going on out here when it comes to these gangs and when it comes to what's happening. And yes, they probably all are closed mouth if they know something. I'm not saying that all of them are innocent, because I don't know. I don't know all of these people. I don't know them. So I can't sit here and say they're all innocent. But what I can say is that those who aren't, or somebody would just buying a bag of weed or, sharing it out with their friend or whatever, or they have a little portion of weed and maybe they, or they sell cigarettes or whatever the case, I don't feel that they should be in that position. You know, if they were out here killing people and selling big drugs, big time making money, I'm quite sure that none of these young men who got arrested have any money in the bank. I'm quite sure none of them have any money as far as like money that a drug dealer would have in the bank.
Yeah, it's ironic because when the RICO Act was originally passed 45 or so years ago, it was aimed at major criminals, racketeers. And instead of using it against those forces, it's now being used against minority people in one of the poorer communities in our country. And it seems to me, from what you described, that it was just a round them all up and let God sort it out kind of thing.
Yes, like a form of genocide. Like, let's get all these young minority black and Hispanic people off the street, you know, and stuff like that. Especially with this new regime going on, that's how I feel. But I could be wrong, you know, but that's how I feel. Like, we got this new president, and now they cracking down doing this, they doing that, and it's very hard for a lot of the mummers out here. Very hard. Some of them get together and they talk about what they're going through with their children. Even some of the mothers from the 120 that got arrested are getting together with some of the other mothers for support. For support. So all the 120 and the ones that got arrested in C-Corps, some of the mothers are getting together to support each other, you know, over what they're going through or what they experience.
Did you hear a rumor that there may be another raid happening in the near future?
Yes, I've heard another rumor that, well, when the first raid happened, nobody knew about it. If anyone did know about it, it was the Tenants Association Board, because they work well with the police and the feds and stuff like that. So if anybody knew about that, it was them. But right now, it's being said that they're supposed to do another raid in Boston C-Corps. And a lot of the families are talking about it.
Mrs. R., is there any kind of organization that's come together to publicize this and try to provide some kind of defense for these young men?
Not that I know of. I understand that there's a few groups out there against the raids to help some of the parents. What we really need is pro bono lawyers that are willing to help and give their time and stuff to help some of these families that are going through this.
Is there a sort of a community representative at the New York City Housing Authority in the buildings that talks to the residents and hears their concerns and then sort of shares those with law enforcement?
Nope.
Oh.
We had, when the feds first arrested these young men, the feds came here into the community center and they met with families or whatever the case. And basically, I think that was to try to make some of the residents that live here look down on these young men. No one really knew about this meeting. Like no one of circumstance, no groups knew about that meeting where they could have come and tried to represent the families. The only people that was there was the feds and the people who live around here, and some of those some of the families that came to the meeting tried to talk down about some of the young men or whatever, or things that happened to their child with one of the young men when their child was younger. What happened in the past when these kids were younger, kids, when they're young, they have their little fights, they do little stupid things or whatever the case. You know, that's nothing for an adult to hold against a child when the child was younger, what they did. You have to go on how that child is now or whatever. And like I said, I'm not saying all these young men were doing the right thing. I know that there was one that it was in the paper, that one young man, he was working and he was going to school and he has children and he got picked up and caught up in this situation. He was a working man or whatever. And his family is saddened or whatever the case, and they are trying to figure out what is going on, what's going to happen to him. But he was one of them that got picked up. And that was in the paper about he was the only one who was working and going to school.
Right.
And he's still in there.
I think it's a clear case of the heavy hand of law enforcement going into different communities, making these sweeping arrests really without the specific probable cause needed. There's a sort of guilt by association. I understood
right.
They were combing through some social media for years. As you've said, this has been going on for several years. But
yes.
We as lawyers know how difficult it is to mount proper defenses to RICO charges. It's costly. It takes time. I think that we're seeing really a gross injustice in these arrests that is destroying communities. What's happening now in terms of some of these young persons' legal cases? Are they being pressured to take pleas? Are they facing trial? Do you have a general sense of what's happening next?
Well, actually, none of them have gone to trial yet. Their court date was in July, July 28th. They were supposed to go to court, but the lawyers asked for more time because they weren't able to go over all the discovery.
Right.
So now their new court date is October 28th. So that's when they'll go back to court, and I guess that's when things will get started.
I wanted to mention on the air that there is an event coming up, a fundraiser, on September 23rd at Raw Space, which is at 2031 Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard at 8 p.m. And we'll put a link to it on our website. But it's called a rent party and fundraiser against the raids. So that's September 23rd. If our listeners are interested, we'll put information about that on our Facebook page and website.
I feel that these young men, the main ones who, because I know some of them did some bad things, but the main ones who really have not done anything, I think should be let go. I feel like they should let them go, you know? Even if it was my own child that was really doing those bad things, I would not say that, because it's all in God's hands, and sometimes with the things you do in the street come to light. A lot of parents don't know what their children do when they go out in the street. You don't know that. But at the same time, you know who you raised, and you know you raised them a certain kind of way. Now, if they stray and they go out there and they do certain things they're not supposed to and whatever, then perhaps they might deserve whatever might happen. But at the same time, I don't think these people should be used for information and suffer the consequences behind it, because you want to use them to get the information that you need to build your case. And that's what I feel the feds are doing.
Right. They've swept up some innocent people and trying to turn them to become snitches, in effect.
Yes, because once you become a snitch with the feds, you're always going to be a snitch.
That's right.
They're always going to use you. They'll pay you. They'll pay you to lie. That's one thing about the feds. I know people who have dealt with the feds. I know people who have gone to jail, federal prison, and they tell me these little stories that they tell me. So basically, these young men, you know, are in there. Some of them are going to be feel like they have no other choice, especially if they don't have no support coming from their family. They're going to feel like they have no choice and they have to get out, and they're going to, if they have to lie, they're going to lie to get less time or to get out. If they have to, that's what they're going to do. You know, not that they, I'm not saying that they want to do that, but that's what they're going to do. And you're not going to know who's snitching and who's lying until you start going to court. You're not going to know that.
It's so
they
true.
They don't tell the lawyers. They don't tell the lawyers those kind of things. So you're not going to know who's snitching or lying or who's being paid to tell a lie or whatever the case until you go to court and they have to testify.
You've said that really well, Mrs. R, and we are so sorry that you, your family, and as well as so many others in your community have been swept up into this. We wish you all the best, and we really appreciate your coming on Law and Disorder to share this story.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Mrs. R, and stay in touch with us, because if there's more news to report, we want to help you out on that. You take it easy.
Okay. You too. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
We'll be right back.